From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 8th day of September 2010. I'm Todd Gleason. In a few moments, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Paul Cooley of Adium Investor Services. He's in Oakland, Illinois. And later in the half hour, we'll discuss the cash grain market with the folks at the Andersons Climbers Facility in Delphi, Indiana. In agricultural news, Colin Peterson says U.S. EPA is, quote, out of hand, and he wants to rein in the agency by cutting its budget in half. And some farm credit lenders have lowered interest rates charged on fixed-rate mortgages for 20 years by 1.5%. The rates being offered have not been used since 1958. Dave Dickey will be here in a moment with these and many more ag news stories. Don't forget, at the bottom of the half hour, we'll talk with Drew Lerner, World Weather Incorporated out of Kansas City. And then along the way, we'll hear from the statisticians in Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, Nebraska, and Minnesota. Those are the top five corn-producing states in the nation. It all happens right here on this Wednesday edition of the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media from the University of Illinois. Hey, are you looking for something to do tomorrow besides harvest corn, I suppose, and soybeans if you're a farmer? If you'd like to come out and see what the energy science folks here at the University of Illinois are doing in the Energy Bioscience Institute on the Energy Farm, they've got an open house between 9 and noon tomorrow, 9:30 really, and noon, just south of campus on Philo Road. So if you are in Urbana, Philo Road Extended, head south, and you'll run into the Energy Farm. Tours begin around 9:30, and you're welcome to come on out to the farm to take a look. We'll talk more about that during the second half hour of our program. We call that the Farming World. Tom Voigt will be here to take up on what's been happening with miscanthus and switchgrass and all kinds of crops that you might want to look at tomorrow right here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the U of I. And tomorrow, if you're wondering, it'll be beautiful, a high near 77 degrees and sunny skies. East-southeast winds between 3 and 6 miles an hour. We'll come back to tonight for the forecast. It'll be a low of 49 this evening, and north winds around 5 miles an hour. Drew Lerner will be here at the bottom of the half hour to take us through the agricultural news and weather for the afternoon.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
This is the Closing Market Report. On the phone line with us to take a look at the agricultural futures markets, Paul Cooley of Adium Investor Services in Oakland, Illinois. Good afternoon to you, Paul.
Good afternoon, Todd.
Well, I know I'd love to have you come out and visit with us on the energy farm and look at miscanthus and switchgrass and all the kinds of products that will be maybe in the future of ethanol production in the United States. But you'll be busy, I bet, with working with farmers and others, checking into the marketplace because, well, the futures are having more fun this week than they have for a bit, slightly lower today in the wheat pit. And that happened late in the afternoon. What happened?
Okay, number one, nothing that I like to hear is promotion of ethanol as renewable energy, and, it's a safe, renewable source of energy. We don't have to have troops and battleships and aircraft carriers all over the world protecting our source. But the big thing here in the wheat market is Canadian Statistical Service came in and surprised the world with a very large Canadian wheat stock, and it had a definite influence. It was about 1 million tons larger, which, under 40 million bushels, but it was a factor. And then the wheat sale went to France instead of the U.S., to Egypt, and, of course, that was also a negative influence. The other factor is big lines of harvest going on in east central Illinois. Farmers are pushing combines pretty hard. So we are in the height of harvest, and that maybe was another factor. Plus, I think some profit taking in anticipation of Friday's crop production report.
Did Stats Canada give any explanation of why they had to increase the size of their carryover?
No, and of course there was a very big canola crop. Some of the trade estimated or had a guess there that maybe they didn't get the last year's crop production right. The second factor is the harvest is very wet in Canada, as it is in Germany, and the quality is an issue. Other parts of the world had some supportive news in wheat. For example, Australia dry. Big part of the spring wheat area continues to be dry in Russia, but it was profit-taking day, and it had a direct influence or an indirect influence in the corn and soybean market.
Right. So it looks, from that news and the timing, it looks as if what happened in Chicago was reactionary. They probably have completed that at this point, and corn and soybeans held up fairly well in the face of the drop.
That's right. And I think the corn market is a direct one indirect factor, too. I think corn is suffering from the dryness this summer. We are going through, as I mentioned earlier, harvest 2010 here at full throttle, and the corn moisture levels are quite low. The ability for farmers to harvest this crop continues to amaze us with their capacity at the combine. And, of course, I know the elevator here spent thousands and thousands of dollars on increasing the capacity to dump and dry. And, it's a monumental task. But, the quality of the corn seems to be pretty good. The test weights are so-so. But the yields seem to be disappointing as a general rule.
Pretty much everybody in your area running today, then, I take it?
Well, I would say 70% of the guys are picking corn.
Anybody combining soybean?
Yes, and the yields seem to be fairly good. The debate is will the later beans, will there be a yield drop? The other factor is when I look at the soybean seed, the seed size is on the small side, but the yields are fairly good.
And anything else to add before I let you go for the day?
Have a profitable day.
Hey, you too. Thanks so much, Paul. Paul Cooley is with ADM Investor Services out of Oakland, Illinois. He joins us here on the Closing Market Report. That happens each and every Wednesday afternoon. Be sure to visit our website. The address is willag.org.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and Moline. More information is available from Bob Baisdiffer in Danville at 217-477-6016. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
Dave Dickey will be here in a moment with more on the ag news. If you can, be sure to stick with us for the Farming World, the second half of our program. We'll talk with Tom Voigt about tomorrow's Energy Farm Open House to be held right here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois.
In agricultural news, House Agriculture Committee Chairman Colin Peterson says that he believes the Environmental Protection Agency and its regulators are, quote, out of hand, and that the only way to temper their regulatory zeal will be to cut their budget in half. Peterson says that EPA has received substantial amounts of money from the economic stimulus package and is using that money to regulate. Many members of Congress have registered their concerns about EPA's newfound enthusiasm for enforcing the nation's environmental laws. When Congress returns next week, the House Ways and Means Committee will hold hearings on China's currency, the yuan. Commenting on the recent movement of the Chinese currency after China eased the yuan's peg to the dollar, House Ways and Means Committee Chairman Sandy Levin said, quote, so far there's been less than a 1% change, and that's very unsatisfactory. Levin says that the purpose of the hearing will be to determine the progress of the yuan's appreciation, and in case that progress was not satisfactory, what the next steps should be. Rates on 20-year fixed farm rate mortgages at some Farm Credit System lenders have tumbled from 6.75% in early January to 5.2% in the past few weeks, approaching levels not seen since 1958 and far below the average 9% in up rates charged over the past 30 years. That free fall is prompting large numbers of agricultural farmers to refinance ag loans. Unlike consumer mortgages, where closing costs can discourage refinancings, there's little stopping many farmers from repricing their real estate loans so long as they carry no prepayment penalties. And that's a look at today's agricultural news.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
Afternoon, the United States Department of Agriculture released the latest crop progress report. It showed by September the 5th, corn at or beyond the dough stage had advanced to 98% nationwide. That's 13 points ahead of last year, 5 points ahead of the 5-year average, with progress complete or nearly complete in all the estimating states with the exception of Pennsylvania. By the week's end, 86% of the corn crop was at or beyond the dented stage, 38 percentage points ahead of last year, 15 points ahead of the 5-year average, while 33% of the crop was reported as mature, 25 points ahead of last year, 14 percentage points ahead of the average. The most rapid progress was evident in Illinois, Indiana, and Iowa, where 23% or more of the crop matured during the week. Corn producers harvested 6% of the nation's crop by September the 5th. That's 4 points ahead of last year, 2 points ahead of the 5-year average. Harvest most advanced in Tennessee, where progress was 50 points ahead of last year, 32 points ahead of the 5-year average. Overall, 69% of the corn crop reported in good to excellent condition, down slightly from the ratings last week, unchanged from the same time as last year. Soybeans nationwide, leaves dropping at 19% on average by the 5th day of September. That's 12 points ahead of last year, 4 points ahead of the 5-year average. In Indiana, leaf drop was 34 percentage points or over 2 weeks ahead of last year's pace, with 2% of the crop harvested. Overall, 64% of the soybean crop reported in good to excellent condition, unchanged from the ratings last week, but 4 points below the same time as last year. Now here are the state statisticians.
This is Greg Tayson, director of USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service Iowa Field Office, with the weekly crops and weather report for the week ending September 5, 2010. After 2 weeks of drier weather, significant rainfall moved back into Iowa, with localized precipitation accumulating to more than 3 inches in some parts of the state. Warm temperatures early in the week and several windy days aided corn maturation and dry down, as early reports indicate corn moisture levels in the mid to high 20s. While corn is rapidly turning color and maturing, soybeans are mostly remaining green aside from acres affected by sudden death syndrome. Nearly all corn acres have entered the dough stage. 90% of the crop has started to dent and 34% has reached maturity, all three at least 9 days ahead of last year in the 5-year average. With corn harvest just getting underway, condition decreased slightly from last week to 69% good to excellent. 45% of the soybean acres have turned color ahead of the normal pace of 39%, and leaves have begun to drop on 9% of the crop, 3 days ahead of last year, but 1 day behind the 5-year average. Soybean condition rated 69% good to excellent, down 4 percentage points from last week. This is Greg Tayson reporting from the USDA NAS Iowa Field Office.
This is Brad Schwab, Chief Crop Statistician with the USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service Illinois Field Office, reporting on crop progress and conditions for the week ending September 5th. Above average rainfall returned to the state last week, with the vast majority of it coming in one rainfall, which was concentrated in the central part of the state. This led to a temporary slowdown of the early harvest. However, producers were able to get back into the fields relatively quickly. Soybeans again benefited from the rainfall in areas where moisture levels were not excessive. Growing degree day units accumulated since May 1 reached 2,911. This was 10% ahead of normal. Statewide, corn in the dent stage advanced to 93% compared to only 41% last year and 74% for the 5-year average. 59% of the corn crop was reported in the mature category, compared with only 3% last year and 24% for the five-year average. 7% was reported harvested by week's end, compared to 2% last year and for the five-year averages. The crop reporting district leading the state in corn harvest activity was the Southwestern District, where 34% had been cut. Overall, the corn crop was rated in 60% good or excellent condition, down 2 percentage points from last week. Soybeans in the turning yellow category were reported at 49%, compared to 6% a year ago and 31% for the five-year average. 17% of the crop was shedding leaves, compared to 1% a year ago and 10% for the five-year average. Overall, the soybean crop was rated in 63% good or excellent condition, up 4 percentage points from last week. This has been Brad Schwab with the Illinois Field Office of the USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service in Springfield.
This is Scott Kelly with USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service, the Nebraska Field Office, with the Weather and Crops Report for the week ending September 5th, 2010. Rain fell during the middle of the week across parts of the eastern half of the state, while western counties again remained dry. Temperatures averaged 2 degrees below normal for the week, with highs reaching triple digits in the southwest to lows in the mid-30s in the panhandle. In western counties, wheat seeding began to gain momentum, as did millet harvest. Irrigators began shutting down systems, picking up pipe, and preparing grain bins and equipment for harvest. Statewide, corn condition rated 81% good or excellent, above year-ago levels. Corn reaching the dense stage was 83%, with 8% considered mature. Soybean conditions rated 74% good or excellent, near last year, with 29% of the acreage turning color and 4% dropping leaves. Winter wheat seeding was 9% complete, near last year in average. This is Scott Keller with USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service, the Nebraska Field Office in Lincoln.
This is Doug Hartwig, Director of USDA NAS Minnesota Field Office, with the weekly crop weather report for the week ending September 5, 2010. Corn development remained ahead of the average pace, with 85% of the corn in the dense stage, compared to 27% last year and 67% for the five-year average. Corn in the mature stage was 12%, compared to 0% last year and 8% for the average. Corn cut for silage was 35% harvested, compared to 8% last year and 25% for the average. Corn was rated with 53% in good and 38% in excellent condition, nearly equal to last week. Soybean development was on pace with the average. 46% of the soybeans were turning yellow, compared to 27% last year and 47% for the average. 12% of the soybeans were dropping their leaves, compared to 1% last year and 12% for the average. Soybeans were 2% mature, compared to 0% last year and 1% for the average. Soybeans were rated with 57% in good and 32% in excellent condition, unchanged from last week. I'm Doug Hartwig, Director of USDA NAS, Minnesota Field Office.
Hello, this is Greg Preston, Director of the USDA NAS Field Office for Indiana, and this is the Crop Weather Report for the week ending September 5th. An early harvest of both corn and soybeans is underway, especially in southern and central Indiana. The corn harvesting pace is nearing the record pace set in 1987. Across the northern part of the state, a much-needed rain fell that benefited late-planted soybeans, but may be too late for the more mature crops. The continued dry conditions has resulted in steady declines in the crop condition ratings. Precipitation ranged from 0 to 1.78 inches. 91% of the corn crop is in the dense stage, compared with 38% for last year and 66% for the five-year average. 46% of the corn crop is mature, compare with 3% for last year and 15% for the five-year average. 5% of the corn crop has been harvested, compare with 0% for last year and 1% for the five-year average. Corn condition for the week was rated at 54% good to excellent, compare with 63% for last year at this time. 39% of the soybean acreage is shedding leaves, compare with 5% for last year and 15% for the five-year average. 2% of the soybean crop has been harvested, compared with 0% for last year and 0% for the five-year average. Soybean condition rating is 51% in the good to excellent category, compared with 63% last year at this time. This is Greg Preston reporting from the Indiana NAS Field Office.
And I'm Todd Gleason. You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. Visit us online at willag.org.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
You're listening, of course, to the Closing Market Report from the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. I'm Todd Gleason. We did have on the line with us the folks at the Anderson's Climbers facility in Delphi, Indiana. I managed to hang up on them and don't have time to give them a call back. I will tell you at this point that we'd like to visit with you tomorrow if you get the opportunity and you're not in the field. I suspect we won't see most farmers, but some of the rest of you might want to come out to the Energy Farm that belongs to the University of Illinois. It's just south of Urbana on Philo Road from 9:30 to noon, an open house there. I'd like to see you there, and so would the scientists that work on that. In fact, Tom Voigt will be here in just about 6 minutes to talk more about the open house. Up next, the weather in just about 2 minutes here on the Closing Market Report.
It's National Date Nut Bread Day. Dates have been cultivated in the Middle East for millennia. Dates were introduced into Mexico and California by the Spaniards by 1765. Date palms can take between 4 to 7 years after planting before they will bear fruit and produce viable yields for commercial harvest between 7 to 10 years. On this day in agricultural history in 1636, the Great and General Court of Massachusetts Bay Colony established Harvard College, the first college in the Americas. In 1790, Canvas Wright was born. An American engineer, he assisted Benjamin Wright in the building of the Erie Canal. One of his great contributions was discovery of the ability to make cement from limestone along the canal route. And he ultimately received the first U.S. patent for waterproof cement. In 1930, Richard Drew invented the first waterproof see-through pressure-sensitive tape. Incidentally, 5 years earlier, Drew observed at a local auto body shop that auto painters had difficulty making clean dividing lines on two color paint jobs. And after 2 years of effort in the company's labs, he also invented masking tape, a tan paper tape with a light, pressure-sensitive adhesive backing. And that's this day in agricultural history.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report on a Wednesday afternoon. Drew Lerner of World Weather Incorporated out of Kansas City now joins us to take a look at the agricultural weather forecast. Good afternoon to you, Drew.
Good afternoon, Todd.
Farmers are in the field. I think they'd kind of like to stay there at least for a bit here in our part of the world. Harvest is moving along quickly. What can you tell us about the weather across the Midwest?
Well, I think it just depends on location. It's always about location, right? Whereabouts of Tropical Storm Hermine's latest rains will have a big influence on answering that question. It looks like the system is going to come up through eastern portions of Kansas into the heart of Missouri and turn into southern Illinois. So if you're in that particular corridor, you're probably going to see an awful lot of rain coming up here over the next 2.5 days, and we'll probably end up with some flooding across a part of that region. 2 to 4 inch rains will be possible in that region. A couple of spots may get more than that, and the system will likely fall apart quite significantly as it works its way into southern portions of Indiana. This is a little bit more of a southerly shift in the track relative to what we had earlier today, by the way. So some central Illinois and northeastern Missouri areas have been reduced on their rainfall potential with this event. The rest of the Midwest will be influenced by a cool front that will be moving from west to east across the region over the next, actually later this week. I guess it'll be mostly late Thursday and Friday and early Saturday. That frontal system will be what actually produces rain for places like Michigan and northern Indiana, and northern Illinois, and over into Ohio. And that frontal system is not going to have a lot of moisture to work with, so rain totals will probably run a few hundredths of an inch up to maybe 5/10 of an inch in most cases. So it's really only the rain that's associated with Hermine that's likely to have a significant impact on Midwest farming outlook. I think everybody else will do relatively well. And our temperatures are going to be in a seasonal range. We'll turn a little bit cooler towards the late week and the early part of next week. And then we'll end up turning around and bringing a shot of chilly air in to northern Minnesota and northern parts of North Dakota early next week. There might even be a little frost up there, but it's not going to hurt the crops for the most part. I don't believe at this point in time more rain will come in after that little cold shot passes on off to the east.
And turn your attention to other areas of the planet. Tell me about the growing areas in Russia. Have they received enough rainfall to get back into a good start for the next season, or at least rejuvenate those areas that have been under drought conditions? And then touch on China, too, please.
Yeah, in Russia, the drought in the south continues to rage on. There's a little pocket of rain occurring today, actually, in a small part of that dry region, but we're not talking about enough rainfall here to make any real substantial dents in the dryness, so they are still going to be under the gun to get better rainfall as we move forward through the next 10 days to 2 weeks. I'm getting to the point where I think with confidence that we're going to end up with a poorly established wheat crop in the southern portions of Russia and some easternmost sections of Ukraine. Now, we still have a couple of weeks here where we can get the weather to change and the situation might develop a little bit better. Meanwhile, the northern part of the old drought region is plenty moist, and they are planting the crop up there. In China, the biggest concern right now is not so much the rainfall pattern as much as it may be an early season frost freeze event that the models have been talking about now for a while. This would occur probably between the 17th and the 23rd of September. Now, that's a long way out in time, but if it occurs, it's about 10 days to 2 weeks earlier than normal, and those crops are more immature than usual because of a wet, cool summer. So it could be some interesting damage up there if that actually verifies.
Drew, thank you so much.
Have a great afternoon.
You too. Drew Lerner is with World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City. Joins us here on the Wednesday edition of the Closing Market Report.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
This is the Farming World News and Information from the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. I'm Todd Gleason. In today, on the phone line with us to take up tomorrow's Energy Farm Tour is Extension Specialist Tom Voigt. He's located right here on campus. Tom, thanks for being with us today.
It's my pleasure, Todd. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much. I want to talk a bit more about the Energy Farm and the open house tomorrow, but we probably ought to tell people just a bit about where it came from and what happened to bring along its development. The EBI, or the Energy Biosciences Institute, which the Energy Farm belongs to, of course, is a research and development organization, and as written on its website, is supposed to harness advanced knowledge in biology, the physical sciences, engineering, and environmental and social sciences to devise viable solutions to global energy challenges and to reduce the impact of fossil fuels on global warming. It's also important to note that the EBI hosts 60 research groups, and it's comprised of 120 faculty members, 200 postdoctoral researchers, graduate, undergraduate students, both located here at the University of Illinois and at the University of California in Berkeley. It has the 320-acre energy farm on this campus and also a site in Berkeley, as well as, well, it's funded in large part by a grant from BP. Anything that I missed in that process?
No, you pretty much summarized the website very appropriately. We are a subcontractor. Berkeley actually has the main contract with BP, and we are actually a subcontractor with Berkeley, University of California, Berkeley, on the project. We are here are doing a lot of the feedstock-related activities at the energy farm, for example. We're looking at research and production methods for the different feedstocks that are appropriate to grow around here. That'd be switchgrass and miscanthus, and we're looking at a lot of native grasses as well. But we also have people in our EBI program here that work in breeding more genetics work with some of these feedstocks, and we have individuals that are looking at the deconstruction of the feedstocks or methods of taking the stems and material apart, and so they can be reconstructed into materials that can be converted to ethanol readily. We have our ag engineering group has a large activity looking at harvesting and moving and storing biomass for later use in the development of ethanol. So we have a great many people here. Well, we also have people working on the legal aspects of biomass policy production within the government. We have sociologists that are interested in the switching from an annual cropping system to perennial cropping systems with biomass might change the rural landscape and how farmers may respond to that type of thing. So there's a lot of stuff going on here at the EBI in Champaign-Urbana.
Yeah, and much of what you just noted will be on display in some form tomorrow out on the farm. Maybe you should start by telling folks where the farm is and how to get there.
Well, the farm is 320 acres, as you mentioned, Todd, and it's bordered by Curtis Road on the north, Race Street on the west, and Philo Road on the east, and that's in South Urbana. We will be meeting tomorrow on our Philo Road side of the farm, and that's 4301 South Philo Road. So it's about a third of a mile. The entrance to the energy farm will be about a third of a mile south of Curtis Road. And that would be about a mile and a third south of Windsor Road on Philo Road, and the entrance to the energy farm will be on the west side of Philo Road. There'll be a tent there. There'll be hopefully a lot of traffic and cars heading in there, so it shouldn't be too difficult to locate. We're the site that's growing a lot of non-row crops. We do have a little corn and soybeans, but we have a lot of other grasses and woody materials there that are not all that common to see in the south farming area.
Yeah, so when people get there, what can they expect? And it looks to me like this is set up a little bit like Agronomy Day, though I don't know whether you have rack wagons to take people around.
This will be at a smaller scale. We envision it will be at a smaller scale. We don't know this since this is our first actual field day with tour stops. We really don't know what to expect. Last year we had a little open house and had opened it up in an informal basis one afternoon. But tomorrow is our first formal field day, so we really don't know what to expect. We will have several different tours where people can interact with some of our researchers and graduate students and postdocs that are growing different crops such as miscanthus and switchgrass, sorghum, native grasses. We have a couple of our people working with woody crops will be over having stops where people can see some of the traditional woody biomass crops such as willow and poplar, but then also see some oddball stuff that we've identified to have potential but doesn't seem that anybody's looked at yet. So if we have any success there, that'll be it'll be with some pretty unusual plants as far as biomass production goes. We will also have people from our environmental and ag engineering programs talking about their research activities. I'm going to talk about one of the studies that I'm involved with the Department of Energy. So it's going to be quite a full morning. I don't know that anybody will be able to get to all of the stops. There's just too many stops and not enough time to make it all work.
Yes. I didn't count them up, but there are a lot of stops. I did make note that you had limited yourself to 10 minutes. The Agronomy Day folks are at 20 minutes, so you should be moving along quickly, and it means that you will have to be very succinct in your presentations.
I think we will have a lot of, or at least for the first time through, some of our researchers that are accustomed to speaking longer will be stopped in mid-sentence, I'm afraid.
Well, just make sure that they get stopped so that everybody can get on to the next site.
Yeah.
So they'll see all these kinds of woody plants. What do they look like? I mean, just in general, as compared to what you would see in the landscape of Illinois at this point.
The grass or the woody plants we put in the ground this year were bought as 1, 2, and 3 year old seedlings or whips, and so they now look like a pretty scraggly batch of small trees and shrubs. What we will do with them after this year is we will cut them back to a little above the ground level so that they will coppice or branch out, and then we'll be on a cycle, a harvest cycle, typically every 3 years for willows, every 5 years for poplars. Our novel plants, the oddball material that I mentioned, we don't know because those aren't traditionally used as biomass crops. And so we'll be kind of feeling our way along on how often those might be able to be harvested.
Hmm. And how long has the 320 acres been there? How mature are these crops? Because these are crops that stay there. They don't. I mean,
right.
While they're harvested, the rootstock is always there, or something's there, and so they regenerate.
We planted about 5 acres in 2007, and that was actually before we actually were given the grant through the Energy Biosciences Institute. We anticipated that would be take place and planted 5 acres. We started planting in earnest in 2008. Many of the grasses that we planted takes usually 2 to 3 years to get to a good size and maturity for good yields. And so we're at that point now with many of the plants that we put in the ground in 2008. They're looking quite good. And so some of what you'll see tomorrow will be perhaps a little immature and not fully established, but then there are a number of the crops that have been in the ground long enough, and this is what we expect to see for a number of years to come after, similar to what we would see over the next number of years. For example, miscanthus, we feel, is probably at least a 12 to 15 year crop, and so third year on it looks very similar from year to year, dependent on the weather conditions.
So this is the production side, or what would happen on the farm, but we're doing research all across the spectrum. On the production side, will we have some of the engineering folks will be there, but will there be planters and harvesters and those kinds of things available to look at?
We're going to have a few pieces of equipment on display for people to take a look at. Much of our biomass harvesting equipment is we borrow either from the animal science people here on campus, or we've had very good cooperation with Case New Holland. They've brought in equipment that they're actually interested in testing as they see this as a potentially good market for them to be in. And we do have some of the larger plantings of some of these grasses that they're very kind to share their equipment with us so we can get our materials harvested and they can get some information about how their machines perform in those areas. So we won't have too much going on in the way of biomass harvesting and baling equipment. We will have some of our equipment that we use for plot scale research activities.
And if I remember right, there won't be harvest probably, I would think, because if I remember correctly, miscanthus is harvested in the early spring, March.
Typically, we would harvest miscanthus, so from mid-December to the end of March. The last couple of years, it has been the end of March, or the middle of March, as you mentioned. But we could get to that earlier. What we need is pretty much is a snow, no snow cover and frozen ground. And if we've got those conditions in January, that would be a fine time to harvest miscanthus. Switchgrass, we could harvest similar. We do harvest it similarly, although that could probably be harvested a little early. We'll be harvesting. We have a number of plots of recreated mixed prairie where we're, and those will be harvesting, for example, this year, probably early to mid-November, I would assume.
Are those on the energy farm?
Yeah, they absolutely are,
and,
yes.
And there's ideas that could be used?
I'm sorry, Todd. We're comparing the energy that they produce with the energy that we can obtain from miscanthus or switchgrass, and then actually can compare that to corn or this year soybeans. We're on a 2 years corn, 1 year soybean rotation in some of our research plots.
Oh, the prairies are kind of fun, thinking of prairie fires and taking that energy and moving that into ethanol production of some sorts. Really kind of a, that's a unique idea.
There's a researcher up in Minnesota that's done a great deal of work with this over the years, that was his work was the inspiration for us to put in a prairie, and so we could see how the yields, the energy yields might come out of a mixed stand, because obviously from a biodiversity point of view and a wildlife point of view, the prairie there's much more activity and much more wildlife action there than there is in our monocultures.
Yeah, and so how much of the 320 acres is actually in cultivation or in crops? And I know it's plots, but generally speaking,
it's actually the whole thing is planted, although I imagine we're at over 200 acres in energy crops, and then we've got we use soybeans and then sometimes corn as placekeepers as we're waiting to develop the ground, or if we've taken it out of research plots or production of bioenergy crops, we're waiting for the next planting to go in. So we do have on the western end of the energy farm, we have a lot of soybeans planted.
When we come back, and we've just got a minute left here in the first part of the program, I want to talk to you about your research, or at least one of those things that you'll be discussing tomorrow. But just as a reminder, people can come out tomorrow. It starts at 9:30.
Correct. We'll be there earlier. If somebody gets there a little before 9:30, that would be fine. We've got coffee and donuts. We'll have them out there for people. There's no cost. So come on out, and we'll be happy to chat with you.
And we're talking this afternoon with Tom Voigt. He's with the University of Illinois and has been working with the Energy Farm. They're having their open house tomorrow from 9:30 and to noon. You're invited, of course, to come out and visit with them. More with Mr. Voigt when we return here on The Farming World from Illinois Public Media.
It's National Date Nut Bread Day. Dates have been cultivated in the Middle East for millennia. Dates were introduced into Mexico and California by the Spaniards by 1765. Date palms can take between 4 to 7 years after planting before they will bear fruit and produce viable yields for commercial harvest between 7 to 10 years. On this day in agricultural history in 1636, the Great and General Court of Massachusetts Bay Colony established Harvard College, the first college in the Americas. In 1790, Canvas White was born. An American engineer, he assisted Benjamin Wright in the building of the Erie Canal. One of his great contributions was discovery of the ability to make cement from limestone along the canal route. And he ultimately received the first U.S. patent for waterproof cement. In 1930, Richard Drew invented the first waterproof see-through pressure-sensitive tape. Incidentally, 5 years earlier, Drew observed at a local auto body shop that auto painters had difficulty making clean dividing lines on two color paint jobs. And after 2 years of effort in the company's labs, he also invented masking tape, a tan paper tape with a light, pressure-sensitive adhesive backing. And that's this day in agricultural history.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
You're listening to The Farming World from the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason, and along with us, Extension's Tom Voigt this afternoon to talk about the Energy Farm Tour, the open house that will take place tomorrow morning from 9:30 to noon here on the U of I campus. It's just south of Urbana on Philo Road, not too terribly far south. Look for the tent on the right-hand side of the road, or the west-hand side of the road. It opens at 9:30. You're welcome, of course, to come out. Thanks, Tom, for staying with us this afternoon. I want to talk about some of your research and what you'll be talking about tomorrow. There's a grant from the Department of Energy and Sun Grant to take a look at herbaceous feedstocks. And as I was reading through it, you're looking at Miscanthus gigantus, but there are a whole lot of feedstocks that are possible, aren't there?
Yes. The North Central Sun Grant program is based in South Dakota, and they've obtained money from the Department of Energy to host this the feedstock herbaceous feedstock partnership. I'm the leader, and we're looking at Miscanthus in five sites across the country. But the program also is conducting research on switchgrass, energy cane, conservation reserve program plantings, and sorghum. As well as in our program, and then a couple of other programs that they sponsor are looking at woody crops, willow and poplar primarily, and corn stover. And this got started after the push during the late President Bush years. If you remember, in the 2006 State of the Union address, he mentioned switchgrass and converting to more energy independence here in the country using biomass as one source for that. The Department of Energy, the Department of Agriculture investigated to see if, in fact, the country could supply a portion of its transportation fuels from cellulosic ethanol, and determined that yes, it certainly could. And so these are trial; those were speculative and based on models. Some of the early committee work through the Department of Energy and Department of Agriculture. Our projects are trying to determine in reality if that's actually going to be the case. And so that data is being fed into the Department of Energy, and they'll be revising, I imagine, some of their writings. Some plantings are probably doing better than they anticipated, and some are probably doing maybe not quite as well as they had hoped they would do.
My quick review tells me that the nuts and bolts of it are that you want to see whether it can just be established and continue to grow, and then what effect the application of nitrogen might have on yields.
In our case, yes. In the Miscanthus trials, yes. And in a number of studies, Miscanthus has not responded to nitrogen, and that certainly is, you know, anybody who does a lot of grows a lot of plants, there's just not that many plants that don't respond that much to nitrogen. So we're testing that, and actually we've not seen any big changes here, nor have they in our Kentucky or Nebraska sites. However, in the New Jersey site, we did get a significant nitrogen response last year. And when I say that, I mean we got significantly increased yield in one of our fertility treatments over the zero nitrogen plot. So while. Some people will tell you that Miscanthus doesn't respond to nitrogen. It may not in some locations, but in other locations it appears that it probably will. So every location is going to have to be treated differently. Mm-hmm. I think the big aspect of the herbaceous feedstock partnership is, at the time it was started in 2008, we really, in this country, weren't exactly sure what should be grown where. And that is a big focus of this, is to try to figure out where we can grow these different crops in the most efficient fashion with the least environmental harm coming from producing them. So this whole biomass feedstock energy production systems is pretty much in its infancy yet.
Have you learned anything about what Miscanthus likes in terms of environment and location yet?
Yeah, I think where we see Miscanthus, where I see Miscanthus giganteus, the grass that we're working with now, this is a clone. So we're working with one clone, and there are some newer clones coming on board, and my thoughts may change as we get into different genetic material. But with the clone that we primarily grow from probably here in central Illinois, going westward into eastern Kansas and Nebraska, all the way to the Atlantic Ocean, and probably going south, maybe into northern Mississippi and northern Georgia. We've got some plots in Florida. We've got some plots that we've worked with in other projects in South Louisiana, and we feel that it needs a temperate climate where there's an actual cold winter where the plants can actually will actually go dormant. Here in central Illinois, they certainly accomplished that. As you get into the southern areas where they might not go dormant, that there's probably better crops that we could produce in those areas.
Is it easy to establish?
It's relatively expensive. Since it is a clone and it's sterile, we have to propagate it either through tissue culture, but mostly it's done through small plants that are derived from the rhizomes or from actually replanting, digging and dividing and replanting the rhizomes themselves, which are the underground stems that they produce. So it's different than most any kind of row crop agriculture that typically takes place around here. So it grows pretty readily. It's a great landscape plant, but there's a little difference between growing one in your yard and in 100 acres in a farm field. So yes, we're working to make that conversion.
Expensive to establish, but it sticks around for 13 to 15
right,
years.
Right, and the yields are much better than with corn or switchgrass in this area.
Thanks much, Tom. Tom Voigt here on The Farming World. I'm Todd Gleason.